Marilyn, Steve, Bernie, Thomas, Christy, Tony, and Sarah.
And Ken.
And Ken.
Good morning,
Hi,
everyone.
Ken.
And welcome.
Thank you, Marilyn.
We've got everyone else. So Glenn, Rom, Steve, Thomas, Christy, Sarah, Ken, and Bernie, right? As our guest. Okay.
Marilyn, Karen wanted me to let you know that she'll be joining the call a few minutes late.
Oh, great. Thank you. I was expecting her because she had emailed me. Then I'm going to ask my co-chair if we might flip the agenda, if that's okay with you, Tony, and we would just open the dialogue, first of all, with Bernie, who is with the .ca in Canada, and is a good opportunity for us to hear from him and chat with him about what the recommendations of the task force, what the survey findings were, and what the present recommendations of the task force are. And Bernie, we know that you don't speak for any other CCTLDs, but we are trying to do outreach to a number of folks and to hear from them what their perspectives are. The task force members will all speak for themselves because we're still very much trying to take input. Maybe what we should do is sort of, was Tim able to send you the Word document that had the summary of the recommendations in it?
I don't believe I got that.
Okay. That would have been helpful. Let me see if I can frame this for you. There are four areas where the survey that we did indicate issues that relate to policy, and I will take a stab at them and ask others to edit me as I go along, because members of the task force are working with direct expertise that is more delving more into each of the areas. But the four areas are, at a high level, accuracy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, it's April.
Sounds like Marilyn just went off the...
I've got so much noise on the line, I don't know about you guys. I'm gonna...
Yeah,
we both got the same
noise. Again. Abel?
We're all the same, Ken.
Yeah, Abel, if you give me your number, I will try to bridge you on and see if that takes care of it.
Let me see which one to use then, which is easier. Use my mobile.
Can I have it? I'm playing.
Yep, 44 for the UK.
Yeah.
77 5383 7191.
I'll call you right back and we'll
okay.
see if that takes care of this. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I'm gonna dial him. Let me do that, and Steve, could you kind of just start talking about accuracy while I'm doing that? The first item being accuracy, and maybe you could take a cut at explaining the issue in relation to accuracy to Bernie, and then I'll be right back with Abel.
Okay. I think Marilyn was really just walking through the recommendations of the draft report, and a lot of this is based on the survey that we did. A lot of people were concerned about the accuracy of WHOIS data, so we have a subgroup that's looking at what can be done within the. Again, I should say this issue is focused almost entirely on the GTLD side, but we are looking at things that could be done within the context of the existing agreements, things that might require a change of policy.
Okay, we're back, and I have Abel with me.
And I think I've done.
Good enough.
So, Marilyn, you can pick up again with our second of four.
Okay. The second issue is the accuracy, uniformity, and consistency of data elements, including across all GTLDs, would include CCTLDs, which we're particularly interested in adding with some of the CCTLDs. The issue of better searchability of the data elements. And the fourth area is the issue of bulk access, resale of the data, and reuse of the data for purposes other than that for which it was gathered. So in each of those four areas, Bernie, we are trying to examine what we learned from the survey and what we are learning from some outreach that we are trying to do, not to replace public comment, because there needs to be robust public comment, but to try to better inform ourselves as a task force about the views that others have. So we might start with, and we are making a distinction, and Steve may have said this while I was off the phone, we are making a distinction between the issue of accuracy of the data and who gets access to that accurate data. The point that the task force has made from the survey findings, we found that who is important to those who responded to the survey, regardless of whether they are ISPs, trademark holders, individuals, companies, law enforcement, et cetera. Then there was a set of questions asked for viewpoints about the CCTLDs in particular. So 2 points again. We make a distinction between accuracy and between then the decision of who would get access to the data and under what terms and conditions. And
excuse me, Ms. Cade.
Yes.
This is Patricia with AT&T.
Yes.
I have made several attempts to reach Mr. Hakeem Rahman. I have had poor transmission twice. I have been disconnected twice.
Okay.
But this time, no one answers.
Okay. Then we will just assume we've done our best. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, operator. Can I ask if anyone else has joined you?
My line dropped at some point on the redrawn.
It's Tim Denton. Hello. Good morning.
Hi, Tim. The Word document had the four issues in it that I sent out to everyone.
Yes.
Could you forward that on? We have Bernie on, and I don't think Bernie has that.
Okay, I will look it and send it on to Bernie.
Okay. So, Bernie, sorry that you didn't have that ahead of time. I had hoped I had provided to people so it could be sent out to any CCTLD managers. Maybe we could just start with the issue of accuracy, and rather than throwing you into the briar patch on all the issues, could you tell us a little bit about .ca and .ca's approach to WHOIS, realizing that we shouldn't be extrapolating to other CCs, but just share with us a bit about the approach that .ca takes to WHOIS?
Sure, I'll be happy to. I guess one of the points when we built the registry was to avoid the known problems in CNO relative to validity of the registry data. So I perfectly concur that there are two issues. There's the validity of the information, and there is access of information. Currently, what we do is we're a low-volume registry. We only have about 300,000 entries in the registry, and we do about 10,000 to 15,000 a month. This is no great secret. We actually eyeball every single registration that comes in every day. And actually, it's funny. I've been working on the numbers, so I can tell you. We actually flag for... We've developed a system, and we've trained operators, and it gets done very quickly. Basically, you spend about an hour a day doing this work. We flag about 20% of our registrations, which can be for a number of reasons. One of the things that is commonly a problem is that we have presence requirements. .ca registrations are only for Canadians and Canadian companies, so getting registrations from Italy or somewhere else in the world will usually raise a flag, although that is a much lower problem than obviously incorrect registration information. If you do say that you have eligibility requirements, that also means that you must fit into one of the boxes that makes you eligible, so we do generate a fair amount of hits relative to that, which are probably not directly germane to this conversation. However, one of the things that we have noticed in our system, we've just finished doing some some statistics is that of all the registrations that we flag, which is about 20% of our volume, about at least 85% of the time we have a valid complaint, I would say. So, and these things get fixed. So what we found from our experience of trying to keep on top of it, once the registrars notice that you are keeping on top of it, a lot of them will get to it and really bring down their performance relative to providing valid information, because word gets around, basically. People know that it's a purely automated system, and there are very few checks. In the beginning, we were just getting just about everything.
Bernie, can I ask you a question about that? What kind of, in terms of the format that people follow to input the data, do you consider the form I'm looking at as a registrant to be pretty standard with what they would see if they were registering in the GTLD or other
Fairly standard. We just ask for a few more things.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but I mean, the layout is, I would say, a dead ringer for the GTLD forms. It's just we ask for more information.
And again, would you just highlight that again for us? It's the Nexus issue, right?
Yes, it's the Nexus issue. So when you give a registrant name, we will ask for which type of registrant you fit in relative to our 17 categories. And that does create a fair amount of, or it did, less so now, but early on it created more confusion. Now registrars are more able to handle that. So the categories, just to give an idea, is Canadian corporation, Canadian citizen, Canadian resident, etc.
Or big multinational corporation like AT&T trying to do business in Canada.
No, that doesn't work. You have to be a registered company in Canada.
We are. Sorry.
Yes, I know. The only exception, just to be clear for people, is foreign companies do not require a national presence if they have formally registered a trademark in Canada. So they can register the trademark name or around it.
You formally, meaning formally, that's they've registered with your counterpart to the trademark office, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, okay, got it, okay. Did anybody else have questions for Bernie? That's very helpful and very interesting information about the experience you have in the manual aspect of it, the use of the operators.
Bernie, this is Steve Metalis. Could you repeat again how many registrations you're receiving a day?
Oh, receiving a day, 300 to 600, depends on the time of year.
And do you have a turnaround time on processing?
Well, these registrations have been accepted, okay?
Okay.
So it's not that they're waiting for us.
Okay.
What we do is we have a 30-day period once a registration is accepted that we can drop it for any reason. So after a registration is accepted, we, on a daily basis, go through them and look at all the data elements.
Uh-huh.
And basically, we've developed parameters for operators, and they just basically scan this list. So I would tell you that, scanning about 500 registrations is probably an hour's work a day.
And so if you were to encounter, for instance, a registration, if they were to encounter a registration that was very obviously incorrect, the telephone number is it has 10 digits, but it's XXXXXXX, blah, 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 right?
Actually, I should note that we are starting to have a fairly elaborate suite of automatic checking, and that wouldn't make it through. The registration would not be accepted in the first place on that one.
So could go back and tell us a bit about that. So tell me who can act as a registrar to .ca?
Anyone who gets certified, basically. We have a competitive market currently. We have about 82 certified registrars, everything from the single-man shop to all the way up the status line to two cows.
Huh?
And basically, with corresponding volumes, of course. What we do is registrars submit their transactions pretty much as in any other systems. We're not EPP yet, but are looking at doing that. And basically, we will parse the transaction on a number of checks, which include the data elements, the phone number. We've got a long series of checks to try and make sure that it is a valid phone number, and you cannot submit an application without a valid phone number. That'll get rejected, too.
Bernie, this is Steve again. Are those checks that you run at the automated, before registration is accepted, are those, have you devised those yourself, or is there some off-the-shelf?
No, we started looking at trying to find something, and it really didn't work. So basically, these are homemade, and we find you've got to tweak them continually, because sometimes what looks like a good idea when you roll it out and test it doesn't pan out, so you've got to scale back on a couple of things. To do it the least bit aggressively is a work of art versus just straight programming. Otherwise, you end up rejecting way too many registrations.
Hi, Bernie. It's Ken Stubbs. Can I ask a question?
Hi, Ken. How you doing?
Fine.
Good.
Fine. Now, did you, in effect, start this system when you bought .ca up again with under the new management?
Correct. We started this in December 2000, although I should say we didn't have these checking rules in December 2000. Basically, we started looking at what we were getting in for registrations, I would say sometime in March 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And started manually going through them around that time frame and noticing we were having a problem. Then we instituted a sort of a formal everyday going through it process probably in the April-May time frame of 2001. And since then we've been working on it. After we did a couple of months of manually going through it, we picked out the core elements that just jump out, and we automated those because there are quite a few that's fairly simple to automate.
So for all intents and purposes, you more or less instituted a process that allows you to take the daily batches and do a quality control analysis on the data that comes in the daily batches. Is that it?
That is correct, sir.
Okay, so right now I'm just
two phases. We use that to keep reinforcing the automatic checking, which will let a registration through or not.
I see.
And then we do a secondary manual check after a registration is accepted.
Okay, right now I'm just trying to get a feel for volume because it would kind of help us.
Yeah.
Currently under management, how many second-level domains do you have? Or I don't know whether you use second or third level in .ca, but how many domains?
We do, believe it or not, we do fourth, third, and second. Total domains under management is about 305,000 as we speak.
Right.
And we do a volume of about 400, 500, 600 a day, depending on the day.
Okay.
Bernie, and this question relates to Ken's question on the automated checking.
Yes.
So you check, you can closely, you can easily reject bogus telephone numbers because of, some of the digits may be wrong, but it's pretty hard. And we can obviously figure out what the right number of digits are depending on country, what the right country code is, what the approved area codes are, those kinds of things.
That is correct.
So you're able to screen pretty closely on that.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're able, tell us again what else you're able to screen on an automated basis besides telephone number?
Part of it is really probably of low interest to this group, concentrating on GTL, the applications. Because of our nexus requirement, you have to identify a type. And so a lot of our checking algorithms go to identifying if the registrant name has coherence with the type that is selected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's probably of little interest to you. We do, however, also check names, just the name of the registrant. to avoid things. Admin contacts, we want a real person.
Yeah.
So we try. We have a list of things that we do not accept, like DNS manager, ISP manager.
Do you use an answer back system or something like that for the real person? In other words, do you send them on behalf of either the registrar or the registry an email which requires an answer back in order to activate or something like that, Bernie?
No, we don't.
Okay.
Bernie, this is very interesting to us because when you think about it, in the sponsored TLDs, the need to check a nexus with something that proves you belong in that sponsorship group. You know, one of the things that has been beneficial to preventing fraud and preventing and trademark infringement and other things has been in the sponsored TLDs, there has to be a nexus of some kind.
Yes.
So your experience with this, I think, would actually be very interesting to this group. Secondly, and this may get us into the touchy subject, but this is my job to do, right? When we get to the next topic, the task force found in our survey significant interest on the part of the respondents to the survey to consistency and uniformity in the data elements which are made available in WHOIS. And I believe we could safely say, we have not made final recommendations. We could end up split on this. But based on the survey, we found a need for WHOIS in the CCTLD community, in the provision of CCTLDs. This task force is not as familiar as we necessarily could be. I've done a survey to the extent I can of the volumes of registrations in the CCTLDs based on information available from the industry, from the websites when they make that information publicly available, and from the ICANN website, showing that it ranges somewhere between less than well under 500 to the roughly 4 million or 5 million that exist in the two very large CCTLDs in Europe, .de and .uk.
Right.
But obviously, significant spread and diversity, including some CCTLDs that require a nexus, some that don't, a very few that operate as we might call in an open manner, where they actively market themselves as a either an open TLD, encouraging others to from not in the country to sign up, or even market themselves in a specialized way, such as .tv.
Right.
What are your views about the issues related to WHOIS broadly and the CCTLD community?
Oh, well.
I know.
Talk a bit. You've opened the bear trap. I'm not going to talk for anyone else.
It's the bear.
Yeah. says the Care Bear. I can talk to this from a .ca point of view, and probably a perspective which is a little different than what you're considering. Canada just passed some federal privacy legislation which is rather stringent a year and a half ago, and the province in which we operate, which is Ontario, has done so this summer. We are in the process of completing our analysis of the impact of those two pieces of legislation on our activities, specifically WHOIS. The early results on this, what's showing, is that really the only people who've gone around the ability or the right of a client, meaning the registrant, to preserve information is the telephone company in Canada. The government, because of its regulatory agency status with the telephone companies through the CRTC, the Canadian Radio and Telecommunications, granted the telephone company a right without the client exclusively freeing that information. So it's a negative confirmation, if you will.
Yeah, Bernie, that is, as my understanding about that, and I actually lobbied 3 or 4 years ago on your federal privacy legislation,
right.
But it's been quite a while now for me. My understanding about that exception is that it relates only to voice telephony directories. Would that be your...
That is correct.
Okay.
So right now we've got this very narrow... the point I was trying to make is there's this one very narrow exception.
Right.
The rest of it seems to point to the supplier having the responsibility to keep the information confidential, if so, unless formally requested by the client. So that's an interesting take on it, which we will, we're looking at right now and sort of thinking on a public who is, if you will, maybe what we're thinking about is actually restricting the information slightly more than we are currently.
Bernie, can I ask you a real quick question?
Who's talking?
It's Ken again.
Hi, Ken.
Sorry, I should have said it indicated. I've actually heard from other sources that there's a possibility that you may be required to to contact all of your registrants and give them an option to either opt in or opt out of any who is. Is that something that you're contemplating, or is that something that you've already dealt with, an issue you've dealt with, or what?
No, our WHOIS analysis from a legal point of view is in progress. We're hoping to have that ready for our October board meeting with recommendations, and they could go as far as doing what you're talking about.
And let me just see if we understand this. Because when we use the words opt-in and opt-out in the privacy arena, and Sarah, you're on the phone, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure we still had you. We have Sarah Andrews, who is with EPIC, on the phone with us, who's a member of our task force, Bernie.
Right.
When we use the words opt-in and opt-out, those are somewhat loaded words in that they have a lot of expectations around them. So I just want to be sure that we're all, when we say opting in, that would be you would still gather the data, but the option might be that the registrant would be asked to opt in to what data is made publicly available?
That is my understanding.
What's your view about, well, let me open this up to others, because I wanted to ask you about your view about how people are presently, are you concerned about data mining of your WHOIS service today? Are there particular concerns that you have yourself as sort of the responsible entity for oversight of the WHOIS?
Yes, we're obviously being mined. You take on the standard things to get around it, IP addresses and stuff, but for every block you come up with, someone comes up with a new trick of the trade to get around it. And I think as long as electronic communications information, meaning email address or telephone numbers or fax numbers, will be made available. Basically, they'll be on a public, generally available basis. There'll be people out there who will mine it wherever they can get it. And that's having a negative impact. We find that is a problem because people are so worried about this information getting around and then getting emailed to death or getting, faxed to death with invitations that basically what they do with us sometimes now is provide what looks like valid information but is in fact invalid information just so they don't get who is. And we find that quite often when we follow up with people that we say, hey, your information is not valid. This can be a problem. They go, I don't want to be annoyed to death with spammers and the rest of it. If you can keep this information so that it's only released to people who really need it and there's some sort of a check on it, then fine, we'll start giving you decent information. But until then, I'm going to open a Hotmail account, and that's going to be the email account you're going to get on my registration.
Right. Bernie, do you have a feel for, I'm not looking for absolute figures, but do you have a feel for, at one point a few years ago, I gave a speech and I actually got this sort of validated from Verisign. I think things are changing, but my comment was that about three years ago, about 80% of the registrations in the .com, .org, .net that were really being used were registrations of entities as opposed to individuals. And then there was about 20% where, and that percentage, so that could have included warehouses, et cetera, you know, and then there was 20% that we probably didn't actually know how many of the registrants in the GTLD were really individuals, that is, people not holding themselves out to communicate with the public for one reason or another, but who wanted a personal website. With some differentiation of TLDs, ideally there'll be some changing of the characteristics, and I could have been all wrong, you know, two to three years ago as well. But do you have a feel for the categories and the percentages of categories of entities and organizations versus individuals who want a personal website, you know, not an organizational website or a website to communicate with the public?
Yes, I understand what you're asking. Probably the best numbers I can give you are... That I don't have a really, really hot current one, but I'd say numbers that are 6 months old.
Yeah.
Probably corporations which are separate from public entities for us. Okay. Incorporated companies in Canada probably represent 50% of our registration volume.
Uh-huh.
Personal, which means Canadian citizen or Canadian resident, probably represent 30 to 40%.
Wow, that's very high.
Okay, so that gives you about 80 to 90%
uh-huh.
covers that. The rest falls in some of the 14 other categories, which includes churches, not-for-profit organizations, Indian bands, and whatever. So take your pick how you want to categorize those. But
okay. And are you hearing, do you think, the same kind of concerns from the system administrator at the church or the corporation of being resistive to providing contact information because of spam?
Yes, right across the board.
Okay.
There's no particular, as a matter of fact, probably the companies are the least bit resistive to this because they almost feel like, well, you know, in most cases they want to provide good contact information for a variety of reasons.
Right.
But it's across the board that, I would tell you spamming is the large issue. We're lucky we don't get volumes of this, but we will regularly get the irate mother or father who will phone us and say, you know, we registered a domain name and all of a sudden we're getting some spam, and, you know, my 13-year-old son got the penis enlargement email, or, you know, the African gold mine email or whatever.
Oh, and I thought I was the only one getting those.
No.
I'll just say a word about spam here in the United States. It is, I am hearing a report back from my lobbyist that it is being brought up to them as a problem at all the fundraisers that they are going to. You know, we have an election coming up, and that they are hearing, it's very interesting, spam has replaced pure concerns about privacy. Spam is now seems to have replaced concerns about privacy as an annoyance. And we're hearing it from the FTC here as well as a really significant problem. Why don't we just open this up to anyone? Let me take a few for who would like to ask any other questions that we haven't asked Bernie already.
Thomas here. I would like to get back to the verification stuff.
Okay, Thomas, and
this is Steve Metallitz, if you could put me in the queue.
Steve and Sarah.
What, you mean the black tie?
Yeah. Can I put you in the queue?
Okay, I don't really have anything in particular.
But if I put you in the queue, you'll think of something.
All right.
Tony?
Yes?
Would you like to be in the queue?
Not right now. I'm listening.
Okay.
If I have something on.
Okay. Abel?
Yeah, put me in.
Okay. And anyone else? Why don't we start with Thomas then?
I just wanted to make sure that I really understood you correctly, Bernie. There's a whole lot of noise right now. Okay, I seem to understand that due to the Nexus requirements you have, your verification of address and telephone number data and things like that is basically limited to Canadian addresses and telephone numbers. Is this correct?
No. Canadian citizens, wherever they live in the world, are eligible.
Uh-huh.
So basically, if a Canadian citizen is living in Italy, they can register a .ca domain name without any kind of a problem. So we do not automatically flag on country, if you will. So that's more of a manual one where the operators will sort of try to figure out you develop an instinct about it, and basically you will flag it if it doesn't look like the name in the country sort of doesn't make sense.
Okay, so you only have automatic checking for Canada, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, Bernie, have you given any thought to whether this practice of looking daily at the accepted registrations is scalable? In other words, if you're registration volume tripled or quadrupled, do you expect the time you spent?
Well, as I said, right now, scanning the registrations we get in and producing the reports for the scanning the registrations, identifying the problems is about 1 hour a day for one person. Let's call it about 500 registrations per hour. So for us, it's not unless our volumes start going through the roof consistently. I don't ever see this being a problem for us into the thousands of registrations per day. And the thing that I find interesting is we're finally, because we're formalizing this process and the reports that we get out of it, is the data that comes out of it, because you immediately see which registrars are causing the problem, and it's usually a very clear, pretty much a two hump distribution. You've got the bunch of guys that are on the left and are, probably, 25 to 30% of the registrations are probably causing more than half the problems, and then the rest are spread more or less evenly across the board. So that's I find it just as a registry, a very interesting tool.
And I have a question about that, since you have audited this and you have the results and you're able to sort of counsel the registrar. You can identify the patterns of where they might be lax versus there's something else going on. Right?
Yes, that is correct.
Uh-huh.
Can I get in queue, Marilyn, later?
Yes, you can. I want to go back to, I want you to elaborate, if you don't mind. You said that you didn't think that it would be a problem if it got up into the thousands per day. And is that because because of the automated process is screening out a lot of the problems? Or is it just that it's a minor... It may be a minor amount of time to identify the problem, but I want to go on to a question about how much time does it take you to notify the registrar, do you think, per item, and how much time does it take to actually resolve erroneous data?
Notification is not too bad currently. It's to tell the truth, it's still very much a manual process. What we do when we scan the list, we get a list in an Excel format.
Yeah.
And basically, they're already grouped by registrars, and we just pick off the ones that are a problem. And then the registrar gets his cut of the spreadsheet, which he has to fix.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the process of developing an automated tracking system, because you've hit it on the head. The problem is tracking.
Uh-huh.
So we're right in, right smack in the middle of developing an automatic tracking system, which both the registry and the registrar will have access to, and for which we can track the problems. On average, I would say it takes anywhere from 2 to 7 days to resolve a registration that's been flagged after it's been accepted.
Thanks. Are we ready to move, Steve?
I was in queue too, Tony Harris.
I have you and I have Abel. Steve?
No, yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for the answer.
So
my question dovetails into yours, Marilyn.
Okay, Tony, you want to go ahead and then we'll go to Abel.
Yeah, it has to do with your question too. Very simply, I think the issues we're discussing will naturally concern registrars and registries as far as cost of doing all this work is concerned. My question to you is, you got a fee from the registrars. I don't know if you mentioned this. I had to step away from the call for a moment. And does this fee, which you perceive as a registry, contemplate or have you calculated some part of this fee to cover all these expenses of developing automated systems and whatever operator involvement is called for? Because obviously, if this scales into larger amounts, if this is calculated into your price, it won't affect you. You'll just get more money to pay for the investigations, right?
Yes. Well, really, right now, as I've been saying, given our experience with the pricing model we have, it's been fitting in very nicely. The costs are very low as far as I would tell you for our registration volumes, the complete package, if you will, of producing these, getting them out to the registrars, and tracking them to resolution. You know, in all honesty, if we're talking about 500 registrations a day for us, is probably costing us half a support body, which is a low-end support body. So for us, we don't see that as a huge expense.
Thank you. That's very interesting.
I should note that this is when we're doing it manually. We're aiming at lowering that time commitment from a human resource point of view when we can automate it. And the work for automating this is really, once you've got the registry in place, not a lot. It's just a question we hadn't gotten around to it yet.
Thank you.
Yeah, Abel?
Yeah, but mine is less on accuracy and more on doing this data that is or should be or will be supplied. If they've got to comply with the Canadian law concerning privacy, would that mean that even an owner name is hidden as well, or would certain data still be available?
I'm sorry, there was a bit of echo online, so I'm not sure on the last real part of your question. If you're asking if the registrant name gets displayed?
Yes. Even under the new law?
Yeah, even under the new law, we believe, again, this is preliminary data,
yeah.
This is not the final, we believe registrant name is fine. It can be displayed.
Yeah, but not the address, phone, and such data.
That is correct, without explicit permission.
Yeah, okay. That was my question, thanks.
I'm going to take you back to the bear trap question here.
Okay.
Because we've been talking about .ca, you've had the ability to formulate some of your procedures, policies, and practices in a somewhat new type environment. You have a registry that has some significant potential, but on a growth path, probably puts you, from my understanding, Bernie, my analysis of the numbers, that you're sort of in this middle track where there's a very large number of CCTLDs between 1 million and 250,000 registrations. with a, maybe 8 to 10 above that, maybe 12 above that, and a very large number below that.
Yeah, basically, if you do the numbers .ca as of the end of last year, I believe, was 15th overall.
Uh-huh.
And by the end of this year, I believe, will probably be 13th overall.
Got it. Okay.
Out of 245.
Right. The, what do you think, from our standpoint, realizing that we're looking at trying to make recommendations that deal with accuracy and then three other areas, uniformity and consistency of data elements, searchability of data elements, and then the issues related to bulk access, et cetera. What are your views for us about the differences, and this is just your personal view, we're not going to hold you to it, that's the whole point of just having some outreach. What's your view about maybe the practicalities, the how many CCTLDs would even be have who is today and would be able to begin to implement if there were an effort toward some harmonization of the elements, et cetera?
I think I understand your question. I'll start by, if you do the homework and you actually go through the countries and you look at them, there's a lot of goodwill there. But someone has to understand that probably 80% of the CCTLDs are operated, you know, either by one or two people that, you know, just try to resolve domain names and don't have any infrastructure. The entire registry rests on a PC in someone's living room.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, what you can get applied as standards to those people and the impact on them to get those standards running is, you know, just monumental. This being said, on the other 20%, if you look at 20% of 245 some odd TLDs,
yep,
the top 50 or 60,
right,
you know, people, as far as I'm concerned, people like standards. You know, there, it's not an issue. I think the biggest concern I have is not how to structure the data elements,
mm-hmm,
like getting a schema, that I'm fine. I just want to make sure that there is the possibility of extensions,
mm-hmm,
so that my data elements, like my registrant type,
right, the,
for the
yeah,
Nexus requirement,
right, uh-huh,
can fit in there under either a generic category or a specific category that is extended. But personally, I love standards. Keeps everything simple for everyone, and I think it would be welcome, because one of the, just to give you an idea, one of the things that we're interested in is how many domains are registered in other registries by Canadians. And you start parsing CNO data, and it's a bit of a dog's breakfast. I mean, countries are either appended to this field or over here or this or that, or you have to scan for postal code, and it's just real ugly. And I think anything that will start making sense out of that about how to line up fields has got to be a win-win for everyone.
So we're talking about something like an extensible XML scheme.
Yeah, something like that.
But to get to the other one, what do you think about any idea to standardize the actual elements in terms of a requirement, what kinds of elements would have to be present?
I have no problem with requiring a number of base elements, as long as it's something that's arrived at by the community that makes sense, and that there be a number of optional elements which can or cannot be made in it. Probably one of the places that I have not finished thinking about is sort of a universal...
we need some cough syrup.
Yeah, really. Some universal searchability requirements, and just having basically our Whois search capability integrated into some international tool that when someone pokes something, it'll come and get an answer from us. I'm a little worried that, you know, we'll have to double the size of our registry just to keep up with those requests.
Would you be more comfortable with the idea that you simply parsed forward or pushed forward the parsed data that had been opted in to be included in the searches to a more general location like the Internet, where searches would then happen on location there?
Something to think about. I'm sorry, Marilyn. Did that sort of answer most of the parts of your question?
Yeah, I'm going to be off for just a minute. Can I hold on just a minute, please? I need to be off the phone for just a minute. I thought that was Thomas. Could we take the question just a little bit further on the issue of development of those standards and whether the IETF work that's underway is something that you, Bernie, are familiar with or are looking at?
No, I'm not familiar in detail. I know there's some work that is being done. I believe that given where we are now, the IETF always produces good work, but given this is going to touch and possibly affect a lot of existing data,
right.
I think basically the registries would expect to be consulted on this and have their word to say.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's something that we should make note of, because we did have a review with VeriSign a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was last week, of the work that they are doing on their Who Is project, and they primarily referenced the standards work that was going on, including work that they are putting forward. In addition to the LDAP work, some XML work. It did occur to me at that time that I doubted that there had been much participation or outreach into the CCTLD community.
Yeah, I haven't heard of any. So.
Okay.
And if I haven't heard of it, I don't think there's been a lot.
Okay. Uniformity, searchability. Can we just take the issue of universal searchability just a little bit further?
Go for it.
And I'll treat myself as the poster child so that I don't offend anyone. We happen to register in a large number of CCTLDs and use those names, not for defensive registration, but for use when we have market-facing presence. But we have to police our mark and a lot of other names. We very much like the idea of being able to search across those CCTLDs and GTLDs, and for a variety of reasons, both because we're an ISP, we're a trademark holder, we're a business user, and I guess I think others might have other points here to raise, but if we go to a two-tier model where there is not access to the contact elements that an ISP might need, for instance, or that a trademark holder might need, do you have a view on what the benefit and what changes then in terms of universal searchability? Because if you're not getting much data, what's the benefit of universal searchability?
Yeah, we've been sort of batting this one around the shop for a while. I mean, one of the things... Whoever's got that phone has got to turn it down.
just for their own eardrums.
Yeah. I would say the biggest concern for a lot of people is the domain name itself. Downloading 400 megs of data per TLD or whatever every day and rescanning it, it's nice. And then you have all the information there. But really, in effect, if you look at trademark offices that do work in Canada for both American and Canadian corporations, because there's a lot of cross-border work, such as
right.
your company, I mean, what they're interested in is looking at the new names that come out. And as long as they have a path to easily get the information that they need for a given registration, I think they're pretty much happy. So what seems to be, from our discussions with various IP firms, as we're developing more of this who is policy, is what they need more than anything else, firstly, is access to the names that get registered. Like, what's been registered yesterday? What are the dates? How can we scan this and look against the marks we're hired to protect or manage or whatever the rest of it is? Once they do identify targets within those registrations, then they become interested in knowing who it is. Now, just from the informal surveys we've done, relative to the volumes we have, the volumes of registrations that IP lawyers are actually fundamentally interested in getting the core contact information on is quite low. I mean, it's you know, it's in the 1% or less range. So, I don't know. To me, it seems like you can attain the objective of the intellectual property crowd by making certain they get access to all the domain names there that are registered in a timely and organized fashion, and having a system that is efficient for getting them the contact information once they've found registrations which they feel they need the contact information for.
Steve, anyone else?
Can I follow up on that? But how does that, Bernie, how does that fit in with, if in fact the impact of the new privacy law is that contact information other than registered name would not be made available?
Not made available publicly. Okay.
But it could be made available, you think, on this type of...
It could be made available on an application basis, on a single application basis, on an open application basis, i.e., you know, there are not 5,000 IP trademark firms in Canada. There's probably about 30 or 40 that actively cover most of the spread. And those kinds of people, you could have standing agreements with them so that when they make a request to you, you can provide them the information. You could even provide them the information online. There are all sorts of models to be looked at. So, and that is covered under the legislation that has been enacted and the way you structure your contract. So there's no problem relative to that. I think the problem of the legislation is making it available to anyone for any reason.
Karen Elizaga, you're on the phone?
I am.
Yeah. You want to say a couple of words about what you're doing in .name in terms of the tiered access?
Sure.
And we could forward your presentation to Bernie.
Mm-hmm. Right. Currently, Bernie, I'm not sure how much you've been paying attention to the .name who is structure, even from the outset. We have implemented a sort of a tiered access because of the unique nature of our obviously our registrants are individuals. The TLD is designed for personal use and not for for use by businesses. And we are also a company that is subject to the UK data privacy laws. Because of this, we had to come to an agreement with the UK Data Commissioner, where we said that we would, we would comply with all of our ICANN obligations to provide all the information that is usually required of, generic TLDs, but certain information would only be provided to searchers who are willing to certify that they were using the information for legitimate purposes. So we have detailed whois, which is kind of, available to the public, and therefore sort of as you would a traditional whois search available by web interface. And then there's another whois that we have currently that that you actually have to provide your name, your address, your email address, and then we return whois information to you by email. So that gives the registrant a bit of extra protection because theoretically an illegitimate searcher may not want to provide that information. We're currently working on something that you know even further enhances that protection, and I can send you that the proposal separately if you'd like.
Always interested in seeing what other people think.
Okay. Anything else for Bernie? On the last item, the fourth item, Bernie, it has to do with resale of the data to third parties, bulk access, whether the policy on bulk access should be changed, whether we also in the survey looked at whether people would use third-party intermediary services, such as their ISP as the contact. But primarily the issue that the task force is looking at is whether bulk access should be changed for the GTLD, where it's mandatory now, and what the right policy should be about the reuse and resell of the data. And some of the folks on the call are on a small working group on that, so I should let them elaborate on that. But I'm assuming that most of the CCTLDs do not sell the WHOIS data or make it available to third parties. Is that a good assumption?
I would imagine that's a very good assumption. Just from our point of view, until we get this whole WHOIS issue cleared up relative to privacy legislation, it's just no, period, for us.
Right.
There's just no way. After, there may be consent forms and there may be a reality to make it available, but to tell you the truth, I'd have to be convinced that there'd be a real business case there for us to do that. It's not our primary vocation.
And you hold, I probably should have started the questions out with this, but I guess I thought I knew the answer, and I should have said that. The WHOIS data is held at the registry as opposed to at the registrar level, right?
That is correct. We're a thick registry.
Right, right.
So basically the registry keeps all the registration information and provides the WHOIS service. There's probably one thing that is also germane to your discussion on this last point relative to CCTLDs, which GTLDs don't think of it, but we get banged on the head regularly in our discussions with governments, is that there is some sort of expectation from governments that national data is sovereign to a certain extent.
National data, what? I'm sorry?
Registration data is sovereign. I mean, you are not required to let it out of the country. Operating a TLD does not automatically grant any international authority the right to get Canadian data.
So so let's think about that for a minute with a couple of examples. So let's say that today law enforcement, for legitimate reasons, for investigating piracy or fraud, there was an instance in one of the U.S. states where the website involved in a confusingly similar version of a trademark, but it was a fraudulent site. There was a fraudulent product being marketed on the site, and the state AG got involved. They would have had access, of course, to the WHOIS data because it was in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. It happened to be totally erroneous, so it didn't help any with the investigation. But follow that example into Canada and say there's a website website registered and it's engaged in fraud. They would have to go to the, and it's U.S. citizens who are going to the website and being defrauded as well as others. The law enforcement complaint would have to follow the normal process of law enforcement in the United States going to law enforcement in Canada?
That is correct.
Do you have a view on what that will mean in terms of the burden, the additional burden, and if, for instance, you know, right now, Bernie, ISPs, large ISPs, maintain enforcement desks with separate staff, lawyers who review subpoenas and court orders, et cetera, large ISPs, and I don't mean to compare that to small ones, but do you have a view of whether that going to a model like this would add an administrative load?
Going to a model like this, just so we're clear, what model are you talking about?
The two-tier model, the model we were talking about where, you know, there could be a process where IP folks could have some mechanism to get the data. I would assume that would apply to law enforcement as well.
Yeah, it depends on the model you come up with. I think it's a little bit like our dailies checking. It depends how you implement it and what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
I think if you're trying to be the least bit practical about it, there are probably a bunch of ways around things, and you can achieve sort of a livable middle ground.
Mm.
It's fairly obvious that you're not going to do this for free. Okay.
Right.
That's a reality. However, what's the delta to provide a workable, good solution on this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's that high,
mm-hmm.
honestly. I mean, I look at, you know, just the fact that we keep it, our registry has a nexus requirement, and I should add, just like many other registries, we will take a complaint from any user that the registration data is invalid, and basically registrants, we do follow up on every complaint. And registrants that cannot confirm the information they've provided us for registration of domain names lose their domain names. So.
And that's action you've taken.
Oh yes. So, but you know, the worst case is when you start.
Uh-huh.
Then people get the word out. The registrars know about it, and the registrant community gets to know about it, and. You avoid, you know, once the sheriff's in town, sort of people get in line rather quickly. The first couple of months are real pain.
Yeah.
It's a lot more work. But once the ground rules are established and everyone knows that it's about the same thing everywhere,
mm-hmm.
doesn't matter which registrar they go to,
mm-hmm.
Because it's the registry doing the checking, then things settle down pretty much. I mean, to be quite honest, this is not a huge ticket item for us right now, and we do it on a daily basis. You know, we will take complaints, but I mean the number of complaints we get and then we can follow up is not a huge thing. Initially, once we started cleaning up and we took complaints seriously and people were coming in with them, it gave a bump, yeah, and it was a pain for everyone for 2, 3, 4 months. But after that, I mean, you get your trickle, and it just integrated into customer support.
Let's do one last round of questions for Bernie, and then go on to hearing reports from our working groups.
This is Steve, if I could
get sure,
a few
Steve.
Questions. Bernie, thank you very much, by the way, for all of this presentation. It's really been very informative. I just wanted to follow up on this issue of national data sovereignty, if that's the right label for it. Would that mean, then, that the arrangement you talked about, limited number of IP firms for getting access to a more registered contact data, would that only apply to Canadian firms, or would there be an ability to have non-Canadian firms also treated?
Really, honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. What I was talking about was the bulk of our data. That is fairly clear that, you know, even in our discussions with ICANN relative to data escrow, our government was very clear with ICANN. The core of our data will not be escrowed outside our country, period. As far as having arrangements with suppliers relative to the IP community outside of this, that's a different game. I have to look at it. I'm not saying either way. I mean, you know, part of it makes sense to me. We'd have to see, because the United States and Canada do share certain common ground on trademarks for certain things, and there is a lot of cooperation, so I can't say at this point.
Okay, thank you.
But, Steve, the other question that I think we're going, I don't know if Lorenz is on, but we're going to try to talk with the European Data Privacy, the European Commission, the staff in particular responsible for the European Data Privacy Directive and the European Electronic Communication Data Privacy Directive, as well in our outreach, and I think that this question about data sovereignty may be one we want to raise there again as well.
You're going to want to raise that one everywhere, yeah.
Yeah. Anyone else for Bernie? We have a list of CCTLDs that we're going to try to have some amount of communication with, and I have on the list possibly Chile, Brazil, Mexico, France, New Zealand, UK, and Australia. Is there anyone that comes to your mind, and we don't expect to be able to talk to all of them, is there anyone that comes to your mind as a CCTLD colleague in particular that you think it would be useful, they might want to talk to us, or it would be good for us to talk to them?
I know most of those folks, and you're cutting a good swath across the top 20.
Yeah.
That's very reasonable. The only thing I should comment in there is please do try and talk to a few of the tinies.
I will. I've the question is outreach on my part. I've gone to BK and asked him in the APTLD.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Yeah, ask him for some suggestions.
Yeah, you might want to throw Korea in there.
Oh, we can do that. Yes.
And talk to Kilnam.
Right.
That would probably be very useful for you because he's got good perspective on things and can give you a lot of good data.
Yeah. Would it be possible, do you think, we will be presenting our final recommendations, will be posted for comment, and there'll be some kind of an open forum, either during the Names Council with an open mic, and I know that's news for everyone, but I just heard from Bruce Tonkin this morning, or during the GA, Thomas, and Bruce is supposed to get in touch with you to work on when we might do this. Would it be possible, Bernie, for us to maybe try to have something separate with some of the CCTLDs while we're there?
Oh, sure. Probably people would really look forward to working with you on something like that. It's just a question of knowing ahead of time so we can make sure we get the people lined up and put the time aside.
Yeah, and from our standpoint as well, that we have people there who can participate.
Yeah, no.
This has been very helpful. Can I thank you for joining us, and Tim, thank you for arranging it. We're going to go into hearing from our working groups who are going to go into more detail on each of the sections. You're welcome to continue to listen if you can bear the time.
Oh, I've already been in on 1 2-hour teleconference today, so I'm going to beg off before my ear falls off. I want to say it's been a pleasure. The questions have been good, and if there's anything else, please don't hesitate. Glad to do our part to help in any way we can.
Thank you, Bernie.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's just go to group one and go group by group with a readout of where we are, and then at the end of that, we will come back and regroup in relation to what we heard today.
Okay, this is Steve Metalitz with group one, team one, which dealt with accuracy. We circulated this morning our work product, which really looked at three questions: what should be done to improve enforcement of the existing contractual obligations regarding accuracy of who is data. And by the way, I think this whole section we're dealing just with GTLD data. Second is the issue of graduated sanctions, whether there should be some method short of removing the accreditation of a registrar for dealing with registrars who do not live up to these obligations. And then third, what other steps should be considered to improve the WHOIS data quality. And so we have points on all three of those areas that are in the document that is circulated. I will say that to some degree we may be getting overtaken by events here. We made one suggestion which really was adopted by ICANN in its announcements of early last week, I think it was the second or third, and that was to set up a complaint form for reports of bogus contact data on the internic.net site. So that's one of our recommendations, which has basically been enacted. The second question is that I think our premise on the graduated sanctions was that there would not be any enforcement by ICANN unless there there were graduated sanctions, unless the agreements were changed to reflect graduated sanctions. And I think, again, what ICANN did on last week with regard to the bad contact data in the VeriSign registrar database suggests that our premise may not have been valid. However, we still have our graduated sanctions proposal in there.
I'm sorry. Tell me what you mean about your premise about what?
Well, the premise was that there would not be any enforced, that ICANN would not enforce these WHOIS data accuracy obligations or would be extremely hesitant to do so if the only thing it could do was to threaten to take away the accreditation of the registrar. And that's exactly what it did on last Monday or Tuesday. So, put it this way, if anyone thought that was an insurmountable hurdle, it's not. Whether it's the right way to proceed or not is another question, but I just point that out. That,
yeah, but Steve, you know, there may also be a practicality of it might be extremely hard to cancel an accreditation of a registrar.
Right, and as well it should be, but all I'm saying is that it appears that at least they were willing to begin the process under the current system.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily, I'm not suggesting that our recommendations on graduated sanctions are no longer valid. I'm just putting that into context.
Yeah.
And then the third, we had a discussion about some other steps that could be taken, such as reviewing and validating all WHOIS data upon renewal of a registration. It's kind of interesting that what we just heard about from .ca suggests that at least for a registry of that size, they don't seem to have a problem to actually take some limited amount of time to check these registrations. So whether that's why I asked him the question about scalability, because obviously some of the GTLD registries are quite a bit larger than that.
You know, the interesting thing that I heard, because I've heard this complaint before, that I have to get my domain name registered. The reality is that after you register domain name, you got to get the DNS hosted, you got to get the website built, etc. So the way they seem to have addressed that problem is the domain name is registered, but then there's a 30-day period where if there's an error, they have time to correct inaccurate data. That would normally probably be, maybe 30 days is long to someone, Christy, who's building a website, but usually it's the question of getting the domain name reserved, I think, rather than actually throwing it into work overnight. There may be instances where something comes up and it's urgent to get a business up overnight or a communication site up overnight, but that period they built in was interesting to me.
Well, yeah, well, their 30-day period also doesn't hinder the ability to get that website up in 72 hours. It just simply says if your guys aren't who you say you are, within 30 days we might terminate your registration, was what I understood. I like that, too.
Yeah, that seemed to me to be very practical.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Anything else for Steve? Oh, and what, Steve, did you guys address the accuracy issue in terms of automating certain, having, you were saying validating upon renewal. Did you guys discuss validating certain fields upon registration?
Yes, we have a recommendation. It's recommendation 4A of the first part of our paper.
Uh-huh.
It says they should use, ICANN should instruct registrars to use commonly available automated mechanisms to screen out obviously incorrect contact data. So I think that's basically what Bernie was talking about. .ca does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the comment about renewal, Marilyn,
mm-hmm.
which was, I think was one of my suggestions,
yeah.
was that the point was brought up, what about all the existing registrations that haven't been screened?
Oh, yeah.
And the suggestion was, well, let's screen them when they renew.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So we would have, worst case, we would have a cycle that is constantly iterating because domain names are renewing, they're lapsing and renewing, and so at the end of a year's period, we could, in theory, have revalidated all of the existing, except for the fact that there are registrars that that sell names for multiple years?
First, that one, and second, I could imagine that strict verification upon renewal policy could actually get some cases of aged data into very much trouble. Imagine someone registered a domain name with Network Solutions in the old days when you had to do everything via email. Further, imagine that this person has given an email address with a large internet provider which has gone bankrupt, so the email address doesn't work anymore. That person won't have had any possibility at all to fix their contact information. They even won't have that possibility when they move. What are you going to do about this case, for instance? The registrar's only choice would basically be to delete the registration because they have lost most of the contact data. As long as people renew domains in time, and everybody can renew any domain, as long as that happens, the domain name doesn't go away currently. But you are in deep problems. Once you really try to revalidate. Okay, you are in deep problems too when you want to change name service and things like that, but you may be able to work around that for a considerable amount of time.
Thomas, let me ask everyone a question. I think I had made reference to this last week, or maybe I just thought I meant to. There may need to be something like a redemption grace period in this space as well. Steve, I don't know if you guys... Tony may have thought about. So right now it's 15 days. If the data, if it falls into the category that Thomas just identified, where you've tried to contact the registrant is using an email address with, I'll pick on, Excited Home. everyone on the call knows that they don't exist anymore. And... The registrant didn't change their contact information. Should we look at saying that upon the registrar may be given if you make the site go dark and you publish on the internet site a place to ask for help, and it's not a complaint. It is, you know, it's a form you fill out to. That could go to the, so the registrant could note that they believe they have, that their site has gone dark, they don't understand why, could this be referred to their registrar? Should we be thinking about something of that nature for those kind of cases that Thomas just mentioned?
Well, I'm not sure, I may have missed what the scenario was, but... Are you assuming that in that case the registrant didn't know that Excited Home no longer existed?
Well, no, they probably didn't know that, but people do not go back into the various databases where they've registered this information and proactively change it, because they're not assuming, I bought my domain name for 10 years, Steve.
Yeah, but they also bought it under an agreement that said they will update it when their contact information changes.
Okay, and now the part of the contact information which is used to validate updates goes out of business fairly quickly. What are you doing now?
The email address that you've given is one that you're supposed to keep current.
Yes, of course.
Steve,
the problem is, if your email provider goes out of business, you cannot receive a challenge to which you have to respond in order to validate
your
request.
Yeah, I understand that, but how long should you wait after your email provider goes out of business before updating your...
You can't update with current procedures. That's a problem.
You can't update because updates are only accepted from that email address?
Yes. You can only update if you reply...
Right.
Under some circumstances. You can only update if you reply to a message... You get under that address, if I recall this correctly, for some scenarios.
That's right.
So it becomes a pain in the butt to update this.
Well, it's
close to
it's
impossible for anyone. Pardon me?
It's definitely worth looking into that scenario, because that I think someone has mentioned before that if it's too difficult to update your information, then people aren't going to do it. And,
precisely.
Steve, one of the complaints that a lot of registrants have is the issue that whether they're businesses or individual is the issue that Thomas has identified. You literally, and we have had that experience as well, you literally cannot get back to, there's no automated way to update it, and it sometimes takes weeks to get a response from a particular service desk. So time could go by, and it's not really the registrant's fault.
And when you have to move your home address during that time, you're quickly getting completely out of touch with the registrar.
So let me ask you guys to think about, it's 15 days now, I think you should think about asking, are there circumstances where an exception to that should be given, as long as the registrar is making an effort to contact the registrant? And then do we need a place where a registrant can ask questions like an FAQ or something of that nature that says, what do I do now?
Problem is how to get them to find it. Where do you look when your domain name has gone dark? And you know pretty precisely that network solutions help desk is crap. I'm sorry, they are. I suppose you'll complain loudly on some online forums and look for a new domain name and something like that, and I don't believe that this is something which should reasonably be imposed upon registrants. However, one idea which maybe we're thinking about is to look at the deadlines, really. 2 weeks may be okay for a pretty fresh registration. If the domain name is just 2 months old and the data looks fishy, 2 weeks may be okay. If the domain name is 6 years old and the data looks fishy, then 2 weeks is out of proportion. So I would suppose that maybe something like something which depends on the duration of the current registration of the domain name may be more appropriate. And maybe one could even say, okay, let's forget about old domain names. They are unlikely to bring up new infringement problems anyway.
Well, I wouldn't accept that assumption. But I think the problem with the duration issue, you're right, I think you've identified an issue that we need to look at. I think the problem with the duration issue is I'm not sure it's always easy to tell what the duration of the registration has been, especially if it's changed registrars. So, you know, I don't know if a sliding scale will work, but I think we need to look at this question.
Yeah, and Steve, I'm going to move us to the next group, but I'm going to ask your group to think about whether, should there be some options. You probably want to take comments from the, I don't think ours will want to have a lot of different kinds of different dates. You know, the more uniformity probably the better, but you probably do need some kind of an exception approach to recommend. And does anyone have questions for Steve and his team before we move on? Group two.
Hi, this is Ron. I've forwarded to the group an hour ago a working draft of the results of Group 2's work on uniformity and consistency. I won't go through the entire document, but I'll mention the key points. One of the points that we're recommending is that it might be worth considering the situation of GTLDs and CCTLDs individually or separately due to differing law and contractual provisions. That's the first point. The second point talks about or recommends that ICANN should take action against registrars that omit whois data elements or present such whois data in irregular formats, and that more vigorous enforcement of existing obligations will help resolve the problem of dissimilar data elements being presented across multiple GTLDs. The consistency and uniformity, so that's the second point. Third point, or third recommendation, is really not a recommendation, but an observation that uniformity and consistency problems are much less serious in registries that use the EPP thick registry model, and therefore ICANN should encourage registries that are not now using this thick registry model to migrate towards it. Note that today ICANN only requires that new registries or registries move to the EPP standard, but not to a thick registry model. And we believe that the thick registry model allows for a much greater degree of uniformity and consistency of who is data. So that's the observation and recommendation. Point number four is really to do with ccTLDs. A few ccTLD registries have signed contractual agreements with ICANN and have obligated themselves to carry out future ICANN-adopted policies regarding WHOIS. And what we're suggesting is that insofar as local laws do not prevent the ccTLDs from conforming to these policies, that ICANN should encourage ccTLDs to take the necessary steps to ensure that they do come in alignment with where gTLD registries are. So that's a fourth point. The fifth point was to really recommend that some of the large ccTLD registries who have earlier indicated a willingness to participate in a voluntary program with ICANN regarding WHOIS, that ICANN should consider instituting such a program because one doesn't exist today. So we're recommending that ICANN begin a voluntary WHOIS, consistent WHOIS program and create a best practices model that registries across the world can adopt. The final point, again, is a observation, not a recommendation, but observation that there is now a newly created IETF working group that is proposing a new technology protocol that underlies WHOIS, and this is called CRISP, the Cross-Registry Information Service Protocol. And this is in very early stages. It got formed just a few months ago, but is already making some progress in defining a new standard, which at this point the protocol developers are indicating that it may not be backwards compatible with existing WHOIS systems. Therefore, if a operator has to move, a registry operator moves and adopts the CRISP protocol, you get a little bit of maybe a little bit of chaos, but also maybe a lot of consistency. The participation in this working group is open and free to everybody, and we recommend that the appropriate task force members ought to join this group and participate. The document itself provides information about CRISP and how to subscribe and join this group.
Ram, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you that as a someone who used to run a healthcare business, the single words out of the lips of my developers and the standards entities that would make me nuts was not backwards compatible.
nuts! That's precisely why those of us who are interested need to get involved, because with IETF, it's an open standards group, there is a tremendous amount of ability to change its direction and where it might go. IETF works on the concept of rough consensus and working code. So this is early stages yet, and there is clearly a tremendous opportunity to help shape the direction.
And could you tell us from your viewpoint who are the drivers? I'm very familiar with how standards get driven at IETF. Who are the drivers of this?
The actual project was sponsored initially, was suggested initially by VGRS, by VeriSign Labs. In fact, folks that were on the call a couple of weeks ago, they're involved in it. Give me just a second, and I'll tell you who the actual folks who have written the current specs are. Hold on just one second.
While you look up, I may be able to add a little bit of information for our previous discussion on accuracy. At least the SIN registries are required to keep the original registration date of a domain name in the database and to make it available when an RRP status command is issued from the registrar. So this information is there and could most likely are supposed to be made available.
But it's not being made available now.
I'm not sure if it is in the thin registries who is or not.
Well, the thin registries who is really only has four data elements, and that is consistent. It only says who the current sponsoring registrar is. And it's up to the sponsoring registrar to provide registrant and other contact information, which I can tell you from direct experience is absolutely not consistent in ComNet.org today.
We know. Yes, I'm glad to have that revalidated, right. But I think that the original registration date, one other complaint that I've heard is that the original registration date is no longer being made available.
It's iffy. Again, it depends on which registrar's site you go to, you look up.
And from domain to domain, it varies also within registrars.
Okay. So
let's specifically speaking to VeriSign, you'll find some registrar information does include some of the
On CRISP, back to the question on CRISP.
Yeah.
The chair of this CRISP working group is Ted Hardy, who works at Nominum, which is a managed DNS service provider. And the applications area directors are Ned Freed and Patrick Falstrom.
Uh-huh. Okay. And we have an invitation out to Patrick to talk to us. I'm hoping to get him for next Monday if possible.
Right. Keep in mind that CRISP as many IETF standards work, it's intended to be kind of business almost divorced from what's required in from a business perspective today, and it's focused initially on what is a common, the ideal common standard, and then it eventually evolves into how does it get applied, how can it be extended or modified to work for multiple business reasons.
I didn't mean to slow you down. Another point, and then we will take comments and move on. Anything else from your report, Ron?
That is it from our report.
Any other comments for Ron? Okay, group three.
Okay, group three didn't make a whole lot of progress. I did get a part of an example sheet up and sent a link to
that. Thank you.
Sure, and that's not all that we want to do, but we're still working to try to determine what we can recommend and why. I think we've pretty much got the law enforcement intellectual property understanding of what we can do there down, but as far as everyone else, we're just kind of trying to figure that out, and I think that we need to work a little harder this week to get our paper out.
Okay. Group, any comments? Toward the end of the week, I could probably spend some time with you.
Okay, great.
Group four?
This is Karen. In drafting this, we went and looked back at the survey and kind of the, what the responses were. And because such an overwhelming majority, objected to the use of the information for marketing purposes, we have come up with some recommendations that basically tighten the registrar accreditation agreement bulk access provision. My own initial instinct, based on the response, 89% of the respondents saying that there should be opt-in or there should be no marketing at all. My initial sort of reaction was to say, okay, there should be opt-in. But Steve Metallis made a good point in saying that there are legitimate uses that could be, seriously sort of adversely affected by this, by implementing an opt-in, while, there's never been a requirement across the board for opt-out. So, and then the other question was, whether the bulk access provision should just be eradicated. And I don't think we have enough information here to say that, yes, it should be eradicated. I think we need to do sort of more evaluation as to what are legitimate uses of bulk access. So just kind of to boil down our recommendations, we've said that perhaps instead of saying that any third party can have access to the data in bulk in a bulk manner, maybe we limit the entities. And I know there's an issue of, you know, what's a legitimate use. But I think that discussion can be had, and we can somehow come to a reasonable way to kind of filter the third parties who are able to use the information. You know, legitimate use is not including, you know, unsolicited marketing, something like that. We also talk about the fee, and then the question here is whether we should limit the fee, you know. Right now, the way it reads is it's a fee not to exceed $10,000. Well, perhaps we can have a provision that reads that allows a fee, but limits that fee only to the cost of providing that information. We also have provisions in here that say that registrars may require the third party to agree not to sell or redistribute the data. We actually think that should be a requirement. If a third party is accessing the data, that third party should not be allowed to sell that on to sell that on. And then finally, the opt-out issue. The current accreditation agreement says that the registrar may enable individuals to opt out, but it doesn't say that the registrar is required to implement an opt-out policy. And we think that's kind of actually requiring an opt-out policy across registrars could be a way to to protect the registrant data that registrants don't want to be distributed.
Karen, did you guys talk about the steps that might need to be taken technologically or legally to prevent data mining of the Whois database itself? Because right now, some registrars allow what I consider data mining of their Whois. It is done knowingly.
Mm-hmm. We have not discussed that, but we can certainly take that on board.
I think that would be good to discuss,
mm-hmm.
because it seems to me that there's a variety of ways that this data is being harvested, and we talked about it a little bit last time about, you know, it may not make a let me just say one other thing. In the Online Privacy Alliance principles, that in order to be a member of the U.S.-based Online Privacy Alliance, you have to subscribe to a set of principles. Those principles require you to pursue a third-party validation of your self-attestation by either belonging to the Better Business Bureau or trustee or having an external audit of your
mm-hmm.
principles. One of the privacy principles that you have to agree to is in all contracts, when you pass data on, you must require the contractee, the person you sell the list to maintain the privacy promise that you made to the subscriber. So, for instance, if an ISP or a financial institution collected financial information and the customer opted out or in, whatever, if you pass that data on to a third party, the contract has to reflect the privacy promise you made.
Mm-hmm.
It's consistent with what you guys are saying. I just wanted to tell you about another instance where and that's totally a self-governance model.
Actually, now that you say this, I'm wondering if we are really on the right track. I already sent an email this morning about this. That email I mostly focused on the fee model question, but maybe more about that later. I'm wondering if you're on the right track, if we try to say, okay, bug for everyone, but we are trying trying to protect privacy. We are going to get into enforcement problems, I suppose, when we do this, almost regardless of what happens. And we are always, and we are, there's a lot of noise again on the line.
Wait a minute. Guys, there's a terrific amount of extraneous noise.
Okay.
Some kind of music in the background. Chimes. Okay.
Whatever. What we are basically doing is to restrict registrars' options in providing better or worse privacy to their liking. And I believe that in an atmosphere where spam is an important concern, privacy of registrant data could actually be a competition issue for registrars. I suppose that it would be close to suicide for a registrar to say, okay, I sell my customer email list to mass marketers. This would be suicide. So I'm wondering if we really have to dive into the details of trying to regulate privacy policies for every kind of access. Of course, we have to try this, to attempt this, if we mandate that everybody has access. The model about which I have been thinking for some days now goes into the other direction and actually begins with the very first part of bike access provisions. If we can allow a complete list of purposes or parties for whom bike access is required, just like what's in the SIG registry agreement, if we can do that, then we are actually getting rid very quickly of most of the concerns, because we actually know what kinds of users the data are going to be for what users data are going to be used, and that way we could easily eradicate most of the privacy concerns, get rid of much of the exclusivity, and we could even justify, I suppose, code-based prices for these services. I do not believe that we could justify this approach to pricing if we maintain that bike access is to be available for just about every legitimate use. I mean, I have a legitimate interest in pizza or in good wine, but I'm not supposed to get it just on a code-based price. So I think we have to look very closely what we are regulating, and if we can't come to better bike access provisions for everyone by really focusing on the important applications and leaving everything else to the market and to applicable privacy law. It may be better enforceable, as it may actually even be better both for privacy and for users of the data. What do you think?
Thomas, bulk access is one thing, though, and bulk access, so I heard you making a particular recommendation about what the task force might feel would be the legitimate uses of bulk access. That would be one question. But that there are other activities which are underway which don't involve bulk access that are contributing to the privacy concerns or the other issues that are being raised, such as registrars loaning the list or providing access to their list or not preventing data mining.
Yes, and my question was precisely, are these other users within ICANN's scope, are these users within our scope? Should we consider them, or should we rather even turn the things around and say bike access should only be about very few, very important users about which the community as a whole cares, and everything else goes out into the non-ICANN regulated area where national privacy law, things like the Online Privacy Initiative you just mentioned, things like local privacy law can easily be applied.
I'm not sure that I feel totally comfortable with that approach in the GTLD environment.
Mm-mm.
Because this is, in fact, it's very difficult to say which law or rule would apply in an environment where the registry is in one country, the registrar is in another, the registrant is in yet another, and the entity who needs to interact with the data is around the world. So,
well, I think we have, first of all, I think we can safely throw out the registry of this consideration because we're talking about relations between registrant, registrar, and whatever third party is concerned. And second, I mean, we have so many registrars that registrants can actually go kind of law jurisdiction shopping. I can go to a German registrar if I like to, in a thin registry at least. And that's the environment I'm having in mind right now.
Well, you may in the future be able to hop and skip around across registrars with complete assurance that your name isn't going to get lost or disabled or snapped up in some way. But that's not the environment that exists right now. Registrants say they're very concerned about the transfer process, and many of them do not yet feel comfortable with portability from registrar to registrar. And I think it's not that easy if you're managing a really large portfolio of domain names to be moving from registrar to registrar. At least that's the feedback that I get.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to parse this question a little bit further on. I guess my view, I kind of thought what you might be saying is the work we're doing in the scope of the task force. And I'm of the opinion it is, but I'm sure Tony and I would welcome any further questions about that.
Actually, maybe I can put it a little different because thinking about what you said, the problem basically falls apart into two parts. Part one is how to regulate the privacy implications of access, which is mandated by ICANN. Part two is how to handle the privacy implications created by access not mandated by ICANN, but facilitated by registrars on their own. There's two different parts, and, well, maybe we should even get into the business of looking at part two. That's one of the questions. The other question is how many applications should actually fall into the part access mandated by ICANN?
And
do you understand what I mean?
Well, tell me what you think, where you think that it's privacy not mandated by ICANN. I assume that...
Privacy of data access not mandated by ICANN.
Uh-huh.
I can get at the registrar's data in two ways. Either I can say, okay, here's your registrar, here your accreditation agreement, where is your bike access agreement? Or I can say, hey, I've got some bugs for you. Can we deal out something about your WHOIS data? Registrar can say no, but registrar can also deal out some agreement with me. That's basically what I meant by the second part, access not mandated by ICANN. Registrar selling their customer lists, things like that.
Some registrars have refused to sell their list to certain inquirers.
Yes, but is it a bad thing? I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing that there is some distinction between registrars in that area. And that's the avenue I'm trying to explore. What kind of access must be mandated by ICANN? Because it's absolutely obvious that for this access, ICANN must handle the privacy implications.
But I think that's where I thought this group was going when the idea of trying to determine what would the group put out as a list, a short list that said, for these uses, resale of the data or provision of the data would be viewed as legitimate by the task force. What would be on that list? Would it be...
This is Steve. If I could get back to that question, too, because I think that's, as I understood it, that was one of the things Thomas was proposing.
Right.
That there would be a list, rather than just saying you can use it for a legitimate purpose, let's list what those purposes are.
Right.
I wanted to ask him, is there such a list? Do you think there's such a list in existence that we could base this on, or would we have to kind of develop a list ourselves?
Well, we could go back to the SIG registry agreement. In that case, at least, is extremely short because it just encompasses very based services.
Query by what?
Query-based services. If you look at the SIG registry agreement, bulk access provisions, these agreements say you have to make bulk data available to ICANN for escrow verification, whatever purposes, and to agents indicated from time to time by ICANN for the provision of query-based services. That's some unique uniform who is, whatever. That's all in these agreements. That's one possible list. Another possible list could, for instance, be generated by, say, looking at exceptions to privacy legislation. These exceptions would normally encompass some research. They would encompass law enforcement, things like that. Maybe we could get further by that way, but I don't know of any such list which is in existence for ICANN's purposes. My concern about just saying, okay, we permit it for every legitimate purpose, is that I could imagine that any, say, U.S.-based legitimate mass marketer would say, okay, I've got a legitimate business. This is a legitimate application of these data.
Thomas.
It would be relatively hard to say you're illegitimate.
Yeah, Thomas, I don't think I've heard on the list from the task force, I don't think I've heard support for that very broad statement that, you know, any legitimate. I think that's, from what I'm hearing people say, that goes too far. How do we narrow it back down and get, and I don't know, Sarah? I think we lost Sarah. Maybe we could try. I'll tell you guys that the language that went into the .com/.org/.net contract first time around was not satisfactory to those of us who provided language. It was edited not by us to provide more space in that area. And it ended up actually, and I think it was edited because of a lot of lobbying by the telemarketing guys.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really validate that, but that was always my perception. But I think this is the time to try to do. Let's try to get it narrowed, not to any legitimate, but to some of the things that Thomas was suggesting, and see if we could meet at least within the task force. If we could get some agreement among ourselves.
Actually, Marilyn, I have one question at this opportunity.
Sure.
You know Section 337 of the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, which basically says, okay, bulk access provisions are enacted until either ICANN comes up with a new bulk access policy or until the Department of Commerce is satisfied that no single registrar or single market participant or however that is worded can exercise market power. Is that in the direction of what you just talked about, that it's telemarketing lobbying? Or what precisely brought in that provision? Because it's astonishing to me.
Well, no, the issue at the time was not directly related to ICANN, Thomas. As I recall, there was a big battle going on in the United States at that time about the differentiation between online privacy and offline privacy.
Uh-huh.
And so it was not a thought through, so the lobbying was not in relation to who is. It was a broader generic issue that I believe found its way into this language. But I think the point here is we need to decide, are we going to recommend a change in the bulk access policy? And if we are, which I had kind of been assuming from previous discussions of the task force, I had been assuming that we would be recommending a change in bulk access policy.
Yes.
Marilyn?
Yes.
May I get in queue?
Please. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that if we like what they're doing with CRISP over at the IETF, we can maybe help continue along those lines. And that work with CRISP is going to enable us to kind of drive a change in bulk access policy.
From a technology standpoint,
yeah,
it would be easier to implement, you're saying.
I'm saying it'd be a lot easier to implement, and the timing might actually work out as well, because we're really just going to be helping them to
to enable the business process to be written. I don't even know that we get to write it, but we just get to maybe enable that while they're writing all the technology. But that's something that moves kind of nicely with our timing.
I don't really understand what you're planning to do, Christy. Could you explain it a bit more? I'm sorry.
Well, with the CRISP process or protocol, it's going to enable the business processes that ICANN finds important to be implemented in a much more simplified manner.
Uh-huh.
At least that seems to be the goal after reading, you know, the information. And so when it comes to dealing with bulk access, where is the data and how are we going to get to the data and who gets to search what data, really, if it simplifies bulk access, we can identify who gets access to what and how and why. And we can write that down and we can agree on it and we can vote on it and then we can implement it once we have CRISP, or a CRISP-like situation installed everywhere.
I'm not sure it's a technological problem. First of all, I think any proposal to list purposes of the use of a protocol in an internet draft or in an RFC will be slapped around your head by the folks there. I'm pretty sure about that. And second, what you're talking about here is really not a protocol problem, I think. We're talking about the question, really, who is going to get access to these data?
Right, and once we can qualify all that information, they can implement it, and that's great. But the whole idea is that we can qualify who gets access to the data.
Where do you want to qualify that?
Wait. I want to make a distinction here. Because I think we may. First of all, there's the question of can a paralegal get access, and to what level, or law enforcement get access,
mm-hmm.
and that I think Chris does help with.
Yes.
Okay. But secondly, the issue of can legitimate third parties, and I'm going to pick on one just because I happen to know their name, Steve, Thompson & Thompson. Legitimate third party who buys data and builds a tool and services their contracted clients for copyright and database trademark protection. The idea there was that they were actually building a value-added service on top of data that they bought. And there, I don't think CRISP is the answer to that competing service, because that means there's a differentiated service out in the marketplace. And instead of a company having their own paralegals doing all this work, Who is, they contracted with a third party to do value-added work for them.
Mm-hmm.
This is Steve. Can I
please
jump in? I think the problem is the status quo, there's a blacklist that says you can't use the bulk data for certain purposes. And what I think Thomas is raising is it possible to come up with a white list that says, yes, for these four purposes or whatever, you can use bulk access and therefore there's some entitlement for you to license bulk access and maybe on a cost basis. I think it might be worth exploring that. I think if we did, we might want to try to get some input from the, quote, legitimate entities that are licensing bulk access now and try to get a sense of what they're doing with it.
Uh-huh.
And make sure that we have a list that actually covers the things that legitimate things that are going on now. And the problem with the whitelist always is, well, what if you left something out, some innovative new use that people would accept but is not on the whitelist?
Actually, I'm not sure if we have to add, say, internet service providers who use that data for marketing purposes. I'm not sure we want to add them to the whitelist. There may be some of the current bulk data users which would fall out of this.
I agree with that, yes. I'm not saying that everybody who uses it now is a, quote, legitimate purpose.
Okay.
But we could have some better sense of what people are using it.
Can I provide a suggested, this is going to put, Tim, are you still on the phone?
Yes.
Could I ask Tim and Ron, So Tim and Ken and Rom and Karen. Can Rom and Karen, because there are thick registries in the GTLD registry, and Tim and Ken, could you by email get, with no attribution to which registry it is, some examples of the kinds of entities that they today provide bulk access to?
That we provide bulk access to.
Right. So okay. Is it a third party who has told you they're going to build a IP search engine? Is it IP being intellectual property versus
right.
IP protocol? Steve, would that, if we could come back in via email with 5, 6, 7 examples, would that be helpful?
I think it would.
Mm-hmm. Would you guys see what you could do by email? We're not asking you to come in and say register.com sells it to boom boom boom, Aplia sells it to boom boom boom. We're not expecting that. We're expecting a
who asks
and who do you refuse if they're willing to tell you that?
Okay.
Tim, I have I have just forwarded Ross mail on the topic to the entire task force.
Oh, great. Good. Okay, guys, we need to wrap up. This has been very productive. I'm going to try to work with Lorenz to see if we can have the European Commission data privacy representatives on the call next week. And if that doesn't work, then I'll see if we can have my best friends, the law enforcement guys from the U.S. on the call. To just have an informal dialogue with them. We were hoping that maybe, let me ask, do we need to hear from more registrars? We need to hear from more CTLDs. Do we need to hear from more registrars? Who else do we need to hear from?
I'd actually like to hear from some SIN registry, from some CTLD registrar, who resides either in Europe or in whatever other legislation with strict privacy regulations. I'd really like to hear what they are doing. I think they're the ones in the most interesting kinds of conflicts right now.
Doesn't Germany fit into that?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I've got on the list Chile, Brazil, Mexico, France, New Zealand, UK, .au, and I see the problem. I didn't have Germany on my list.
Marilyn, CCTLDs are one of the groups.
Sorry.
But I was meaning SIM GTLD registrars.
Tim, we're back to you. Can you find us a registrar that's based in Germany?
Who, me?
Who, you?
Well, I know registrars based in Germany.
Knip or Putek, I think.
Why wouldn't a German know this?
We'll ask Philip. He is from the registrar's constituency and he's from Germany.
Okay.
It's very
get
simple.
Gravensee to do some work, Christ.
All right. We're assigning this to Philip. We're going to post it by email so that he knows.
Christy, one favor. Could you please explain in Britain on the mailing list where you see the relationship between CRISP and bulk access? I just don't get it on the phone, it seems.
The relationship between CRISP and what?
And bulk access. I just don't get it.
Well, it's very simple. It's very simple.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so. The relationship, if CRISP is going to be defining the architecture of how registry protocols are going to work, then at least in the background, it is a open definition-making process that may or may not affect bulk access, but at least potentially affects how such a thing as this forced sale of customer data can occur and under what levels of control.
Okay.
So that's my answer.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's a definition-making process.
I'm starting to understand. I suppose I should read some internet drafts.
Have you not read the CRISP documentation?
No, I didn't have the time. I've read quantum mechanics, differential geometry, and whatever.
Well, I bet Tim at this point could summarize that as well in writing.
Oh, thanks.
Because I think you can.
Guys, this has been, I think, extremely productive. Next week we're going to have another guest or two, and we will have reports again. And I'm going to post after we go through this. Tony and I have to go through this. We have got to go through and make assignments for how we are going to do, how we're going to draft our final report. We need to realize that while our report, our recommendations are out for public comment, we need to go back to the draft report and edit it, because remember, it was out for comment. It's still got typos in it. It's still got a few other things in it. We need to remember we need to edit that report so that we can put it out as a document that people can return to. And I'm going to post the outline for what our final report has to be in. And I will, after Tony and I go through it, I'll point the areas where I think we have accomplished or still have tasking to do. A lot of what we're doing right now is going to complete the outreach that we're required, is going to fill in the contact and outreach. Then we'll have the public contact period. Then we will have some kind of a report. And Shanghai, let me just tell you that we've been asked by the chair of the Names Council to present at the Names Council call on Thursday the four recommendations and give some view of where the task force is on their support for the recommendation. So, and take comments from the Names Council members. Can you guys, who are not Names Council members, just make sure that your Names Council folks are paying attention to this? There'll be a 30-minute discussion on it. And Thomas, are you? I'm thinking that I will remind Bruce. He needs to get in touch with you about scheduling and participation as the chair of the GA. And following the Names Council call, which I would expect to just be the Names Council hearing the recommendations and providing their comments on it, I'm assuming that we will just then return to our work. I apologize, Tony and I apologize for not giving you further notice. We learned about the 30-minute opportunity when Bruce published the Names Council calendar. Or we would have brought it up to you before. Any comments?
The question I would have, Marilyn, is just seeing what I saw in amidst the welter of emails, is that Tonkin is seeking to constrain our work or to get us to finish one section before moving on to the next? How would you interpret it?
Bruce includes in many of his emails a reminder that he's an engineer.
Yeah.
I believe what he is trying to accomplish is to make sure that the Names Council representatives themselves are engaged and paying attention to the policy issues and do not do what in the past occasionally a Names Council member who has done, which is to get on the call and say when a policy topic is discussed, I'm not up to date on this topic. So I believe he's trying to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yep.
And to push the Names Council toward understanding that they have to understand the policy implications. And having been briefed on them and hopefully doing their job of keeping in touch with their task force members, it's not a duplication. I believe that's very much what he's trying to do.
Okay.
And I think he has some hope that eventually we'll complete our work. Ever the optimist, those engineers. Thank you, folks.
And Christy, I'll be calling you as soon as possible.
Okay. I'll be right here.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye-bye, Marilyn.
Oh.